Okay, I think we can start. As I say, those who have been here since 9:15 in the morning, raise your hand just so somebody can pat you on the back. Okay, thank you very much, and really a pleasure, and it's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Yitzhak Berger, as I said, Mecha Shachianu, as he joins the Torah in Motion team. He is professor of biblical studies at Hunter College of the City University of New York. And Vakasha, time to get started. Esther Mordechai and the Legacy of Shaul. Bakasha.
Okay. Thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me. I'm very happy to join the team. I'm going to speak today about connections between Megillat Esther and earlier books in Tanakh, which I have no doubt others must have spoken about earlier today. But hopefully, I'll be focusing on some things that others have not, and things that are lesser known. Time permitting, I will kind of try to expand things perhaps a bit beyond what I have here on the handout, but we'll kind of see how things go. There are actually several chazals. This is not the norm that you would find a number of chazals with expansive presentations of parallels between a sefer in Tanakh and an earlier sefer. Or earlier Sfarim. You certainly have Midrashim make connections between Sfarim and Tanakh and Torah and between Sfarim and Tanakh. That the Midrash does all the time. But something that you might see in kind of a modern day presentation of literary parallels is really quite distinct what we find in Chazal. And what you have here on the screen share, the handout is really just a small percentage of what you find in Chazal in this respect. We're going to be focusing on, one aspect of the relationship between Esther and the earlier Sfarim in Tanakh, and that is the legacy of Shaul HaMelech, of Shevet Binyamin generally, that you find alluded to in the Megillah. If you just look at the first source that's on the screen, here is a Gemara in that, or that long stretch of pages, in Gemara Megillah, that darshens, Megillat Esther, and which writes as follows. I'll read the Hebrew, but you have the English right beneath, and I will also just summarize in English. Rachel's tzniut, the modesty, the humility of Rachel, resulted in her meriting that King Saul came from her. Shaul's modesty was resulted in Esther descending from him. Now, the tzniut of Rachel, that's already something more midrashic. Many of us are probably familiar with the commonly cited Midrash that Rachel kind of went along with the effort to have Leah, her older sister, marry Yaakov instead of herself. And she kind of humbly, submissively, and even in her own quiet way, actively went along with it. So based on that Midrashic interpretation, the Gemara here assumes that in this lineage, we have this characteristic of sort of a certain quiet humility, and that manifests itself again in Shaul HaMelech. Now, the truth of the matter is that it manifests itself in Shaul HaMelech in a whole variety of ways, many of which we're not going to be seeing today, but I may summarize. The Gemara here quotes one in particular, Matzniut Haitah B'Shaul. What is the humility that Shaul manifested? Dichtiv et Dvar HaMelucha Lo Higid Lo. This is part of the story of the coronation of Shaul HaMelech. It's a very lengthy sequence of chapters in Sefer Shmuel, where Shaul HaMelech is going to find some lost donkeys. He can't find them. Eventually, he goes to Shmuel the Navi, who tells him, "Don't worry about the donkeys, but God told me that you're supposed to be the king." And in various respects, you see Shaul reacting very humbly. One of those ways is that when Shaul goes home, he meets his uncle, who hears that he had an encounter with Shmuel the Navi, asks him what happened in that encounter. Shaul responds by telling him, oh, he said that the lost donkeys were found. But Shaul did not, as you see here, did not say a word about Shmuel having told him that he is to be the next king of Israel. And it takes an awful lot for Shaul to actually break out and act as the king of Israel. This expression, et dvar hamlucha lo higidlo, that the matter of the kingship Shaul did not acknowledge when he was speaking to his uncle, this is one of several parallels that one finds between Shaul HaMelech and Esther. Let's take a look at this next source, which is a very interesting one. It was brought to my attention by the Rosh Yeshiva of Shor Yoshu, which is a yeshiva in my local community, in a totally different context, but I was very fortunate that he brought it up. This comes from a rabbi from the modern period, Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger. Who was Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger is an interesting story unto itself. He was a Hungarian Jew who was born in the mid-19th century. He immigrated to Eretz Yisrael and died in 1922. So he was there during a period when many people were many Zionists and others were coming and settling in Israel. As he was a student of the Chassam Sofer, who was a major opponent of reform. He was a very fiery personality himself. So this very fiery personality, right, you can actually see the personality coming through in what Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger says here about the connection between Shaul HaMelech's et dvar hamlucha lo higidlo, that he was reticent and would not acknowledge that he was chosen as king, and a parallel line that you find in Megillat Esther to a similar effect. He is commenting on a line in the Megillah, im hacharesh tacharishi ba'et hazot. Mordechai is speaking to Esther and telling her that if you keep silent at this time, right, then your own household will not have a redemption. It will actually perish. There will be salvation for the Jews from elsewhere, but this is your moment to salvage the legacy of your own ancestry. And he comments as follows. He says, "Nir el haspir omro ba'et hazot." That language, if you keep silent at this time, why did Mordechai have to say, if you are silent at this time? Why not just say, Esther, if you are silent, then it will have the negative consequence in question. Why is he emphasizing this time? And here he cites a different midrash that makes a similar point to the one that we've seen, which is that the legacy of Shaul HaMelech, of Esther, and really all of the descendants of Rachel, right? Rachel being the mother of Yosef and of Shevet Binyamin, from whom Esther and Shaul descend, that legacy is one of reticence, of quiet, of humility. And Mordechai tells Esther, let's back up a bit, right? The parallel that he cites in the bolded letters, et dvar hamlucha lo higidlo, which we've seen, Shaul did not disclose his coronation. And in Esther, we have a parallel line, ein Esther magedet molad tav et ama, one of several parallels, the same language. It's actually one of two psukim in the Megillah that uses this language of lo higida. We have ein Esther magedet, we have lo higida Esther. Esther did not disclose who she was, even after she was chosen as queen. Why not? because Mordechai told her not to. It's part of Esther's humility, reticence, subservience. And continues Rav Schlesinger, V'laze kivein Mordechai v'amar l'Esther hamalka. This was what Mordechai meant when he made his remark to Esther. Af shemidarkechu lachashot kederech mishpachat beit avot ayich shachazu tamid bebidat hashita. Even though your legacy is to maintain a silent posture, mikol makom lo kol ha'itim shavot, not all times are the same. Ve'ata et latzeit betoch ha'ir v'lizok. Now the time is different. This is a time you must go out and make your voice heard. So im tacharish tacharishi gam achshav ba'et hazot, if you're going to keep quiet even at this time, right, then you're going to lose this opportunity to rectify something that went wrong in your own legacy. Now, what went wrong in the legacy of Esther, Mordechai, Shaul, HaMelech, Rachel? What went wrong with that silence? Right, we've said that Shaul was humble. He did not want to disclose the Malchut. He did not want, didn't seem to want the job altogether. What went wrong? And if you know the story of Shaul HaMelech, right, then you'll know that, yes, there were some very positive aspects to Shaul's humility. Yes, it's true that a Melech Yisrael, a king, has to be humble. And that may have even been the point of Hashem choosing Shaul to be a king, because in the law of the king that's laid out in Sefer Dvarim, it tells you that a Melech Yisrael has to be very different from a king from other nations. A Melech Yisrael must be somebody who does not raise himself up above others. Levilti rum levavo me'achav. Rather, what does the king of Israel have to do? He has to write a Sefer Torah. He has to read in that Sefer Torah all the days of his life and recognize that his job is to implement God's law, not to lord over other people. So in one respect, Shaul HaMelech's humility was very favorable, and he was chosen probably in part for that reason. However, Shaul HaMelech loses the kingship for having done certain things that fell short. And the most famous one, of course, which we'll see a reference to a bit later on in the Shir, is in Perek Tetvav and Shmuel Aleph. We find that Shaul, when he was told to kill out the Amalekim, he did not do so the way he was supposed to. He left King Agag alive, and he allowed that a number of the livestock could be taken as spoils, again, something that he was not allowed to do. And Shaul basically tells Shmuel, when he's called out on this, that he let the people do what they wanted. He did not assert himself. And this becomes the flaw of Shaul's kingship. And so this is what Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger is saying when he's reading that line in the Megillah this way. He's saying, Mordechai is telling Esther, this is your opportunity to rectify the reputation of the kingship of the tribe of Binyamin and of the family that you descend from, since Mordechai and Esther descend from Kish, who is the father of Shaul. So there's a family relationship there as well. Where do we see that the Megillah is really trying to line up Esther with Shaul? So first, let's take a look first at another parallel that the Midrash draws us to. This is a lesser known Midrash on the screen in front of you, the Midrash Abba Gurion, which calls attention to a pasuk in the very first perek of the Megillah, Malchuta Yitein HaMelech L'Ruta HaTova Mimena. This is Mimuchan, telling the king that Vashti, after refusing to do what the king asked, needs to be deposed. And her kingship, right, her royal position, should be given to her peer who is better than she. L'ru'uta hatova mimena. Now, where does this language come from? Right, in an observation, again, made by modern scholars as well, The Midrash says, "B'lashon ze nitlat malchut mizkeina." With this language, the kingship was taken away from Esther's great grandfather Shaul. Shene'emar unetancha l're'acha hatov mimcha. We have a line from Shmuel Aleph in that perek that talks about Shaul's failure to kill the Amalekim properly. And when Shmuel finally tells Shaul, "You've had enough opportunities to come clean, but God is taking the malchut away from you," it uses a very similar expression, "Unetancha l're'acha hatov mimcha." And this is where the language in the Megillah of Lir'uta hatova mimena comes from. The Midrash here is alluding to the fact that whereas the malchut was taken away from Shaul, there will be a rehabilitation of the reputation of the royalty of Shevet Binyamin with the emergence of Esther as a successful queen who advocates on behalf of Am Yisrael here in the Megillah. It's not going to be Malchut over all of Bnei Yisrael in Eretz Yisrael. That ends up being reserved for Shevet Yehuda. But what we find here, and for that matter, what we will note shortly elsewhere in Tanakh, is that you find that the Bnei Rachel, right, the descendants of Rachel, achieve a very specific kind of success, leadership success in Galut. This is where the leadership of Binyamin is going to shine here in the Megillah as well. So then what in fact are the parallels, right? How does the Megillah draw this relationship between Esther and Shaul? Well, so here on the screen in front of you, let's look at the top line where the Megillah introduces Mordechai. Right? The pasuk that we all say together before the Baal Kriya says it, Ish Yehudi hayav b'shushan habira u'shmo Mordechai ben Ya'ir ben Shimi ben Kish Yishimini. There was a Jewish man who descended from several generations all the way up to Kish, a Benjaminite, Ish Yimini. Right, this parallels a line in the text in Shmuel that introduces Shaul's kingship. The beginning of that story reads, "Vayehi Ishmi Binyamin." There was a man from Binyamin, Ushmo Kish, and his name was Kish. There we have the great grandfather of Mordechai. Right, followed by several generations, Ben so and so, Ben so and so, and in the end, Ben Ishimini. You just look at those two introductions, and it already appears that the Megillah may well be seeking to draw a link between Kish, the father of Shaul, and Mordechai, the adoptive father of Esther. If there is a parallel drawn between Kish and Mordechai, father and adoptive father, it would follow that the Megillah is implying a possible link between Shaul, the son of Kish, and Esther, the adoptive daughter of Mordechai. And in fact, you continue with the characterization of Esther that you find shortly thereafter in the Megillah. And what does the Megillah tell us? It tells us that Mordechai was raising Hadassah, he Esther, right? And we're told that Esther was beautiful. V'hanara yifat toar v'tovat mar'eh. Likewise, in the story in Sefer Shmuel, the text tells us that the son of Kish was named Shaul. He was Bachur Vatov, which the translation in front of you, which is typical of translation, says, and he was young and handsome, and there was not among the children of Israel a more handsome person than he. So when the Hebrew says, uses here the word Tov, it is commonly understood to mean his physical appearance. As you see from the last phrase in the pasuk, Mishichmo v'amala gavoa mikol ha'am, he was a head taller than everyone else. So both texts emphasize the striking appearance of the relevant son or daughter. Shaul is exceedingly handsome. Esther is exceedingly beautiful. And in turn, they make a notable impression on all those who see them. Here you have shortly thereafter in Esther, after Esther is sort of brought to the palace when the king is supposed to evaluate all of the women to see who he would like to be his queen. You see the bolded lines here. There is consistent reference to all of the people being struck by Esther, who was in their eyes greater than all of the other women. In the eyes of all who saw her, and the king loved Esther more than all of the women, Mikol Hanashim and Mikol Habdullah. Likewise in Nashmuel, we find, right, Bayigba Mikol Ha'am Bishichmo Vamala, right, he was taller than all of the people from his shoulders up. And then when he finally emerges as king in the context of his public coronation, and Shmuel points to Shaul, who had been hiding in keeping with his humility. But when he is finally drawn out, Vayomer Shmuel el kol ha'am, Shmuel says to all of the people, do you see? Ki ein kamohu b'chol ha'am, there's none like him among all of the people. And all of the people shouted kol ha'am, vayareu kol ha'am, and they said, yechi ha'melech. Now, let's continue drawing the parallel, let's consider a pasuk that we've already seen, specifically the pasuk cited by Rav Schlesinger when he was interpreting Mordechai's intention here in telling Esther that if you are quiet today, then you will lose that opportunity to rectify the problems that emerged in the kingship of your ancestors. The line in Esther, as we've seen, as you see in front of you, Kim Hacharesh Tacharishi Ba'etazot, if you keep silent at this time, right, there will be a salvation for the Jews from elsewhere. Ve'at uveit avich tovedu, right, and you and your ancestral house will perish. So this line, Im Hacharesh Tacharishi, certainly has the meaning, right, that we've already cited. He's warning her, you can't keep quiet now, in keeping with the tendencies of your lineage. But what we haven't noted to this point is that the notion of being macharish, of being silent in an expression of humility, actually finds expression in the text's characterization of Shaul himself. In the same sequence of chapters that describe Shaul's emergence as a king, here we have right after his public coronation, there were some people who did not participate in praising the king and in demonstrating their fidelity to him. They looked at him and they actually, you know, said to themselves, the externals don't matter. They probably saw some of the what they saw as probably an excess of humility, and they disdained him. And the last phrase in this pasuk is Vayehi kemacharish, right? Shaul, in response to these people who disdained him, remained silent, right? One of the reasons that the text adopts the expression in Esther of Imhacharesh Tacharishi is apparently because it is drawing on the phrase Vayehi kemacharish. This is an expression of Shaul's humility, and Mordechai is warning Esther, you can't display that same expression of humility in this context, because this is a time where you need to speak up. The last phrase in this pasuk, Atu veit avich tovedu, you and your ancestral house will perish, likewise probably derives from a phrase in the story of Shaul. What happens in the story of Shaul? This is near the beginning of Shaul's coronation. This is the private coronation that happens at the beginning of that story, when Shaul is looking for his donkeys, approaches Shmuel, and Shmuel tells him, don't worry about the donkeys, because ulemi kol chemdat Yisrael, halo lecha ulechol beit avicha, on whom is all the desire of Israel, is it not on you and all your father's house? This, the line ulechol beit avicha, seems to have served as the foundation for the line in the Megillah, At uveit avich tovedu. In other words, the initial call to Shaul HaMelech to be the king for all of Bnei Yisrael, something that was lost in the dynasty of Shaul. Well, that is something that Esther can gain back if she, instead of showing humility and reserve where it's not called for, as Shaul did in the story of Amalek, if she instead comes forward, overcomes her tendency to you of humility and reserve, and speaks up, confronts the king, and takes the necessary initiative to save the Jews. We continue forward, and ultimately, this is in fact what Esther does, of course, as we know. Esther comes forward and, against her nature, approaches the king. There's the famous Perek Dalet in the Megillah when Mordechai tells Esther what we've just seen, right? Your whole purpose here is going to be lost if you don't come forward. And by the end of that Perek, Esther is commanding Mordechai what to do. So the last pasuk in Perek Dalet of the Megillah is that Mordechai went, Vayask Chol Asher Tzivta Alav Esther. Now she's in charge, right? And then we know in the story of the Megillah that Esther comes forward and uses some very very clever tactics in order to have Haman killed, and then ultimately to enable the Jews to fight back with the government on the side of the Jews. What you have here on the top of the screen is a very famous parallel. Shaul's failure in Perek Tetvav and Shmuel Aleph was, of course, that he did not kill Agag, and that he took and that he allowed the people to take of the spoils, even though they were not supposed to. Now, here in Esther, after the Jews win the day, the Jews are actually supposed to be allowed to take from the spoils, right? There is a line in the Megillah that appears repeatedly of Ushlalam Lavoz. The Jews are allowed to take of the spoils. And what's remarkable is that they do not. And it says three times in Perek Tet of Esther, Uvabiza lo shalchu et yadam. The Jews did not extend their hand to the spoils, even though they were allowed to. Why? This, as many people have pointed out, this is part of the corrective of the failures of the legacy of Shaul. Shaul allowed the people to take from spoils, even though they should not have. The people, the Jews in the story of Esther, under the leadership of Esther and Mordechai, do not take from spoils, even though they are allowed to. Here's a lesser known example. If you continue to scroll down, and just a moment, there we go. There are various points in the story of Shaul HaMelech where descendants of Shaul die, and not only die, but are impaled. You have in the story of Shaul's death that it's not only Shaul that dies on the battlefield, but three of his sons die on the battlefield. And in the top pasuk that you have quoted in front of you, you see the text telling us that the body of Shaul and his three fallen sons were impaled on a wall. Later in the story in Sefer Shmuel, because of an issue that we won't get into here, but seven additional sons and grandsons of Shaul have to be given over to be killed, and you find here that seven of them are once again impaled. You hear the word Shivatayim, which you see in bold. They were impaled on a mountain. So we have all together three plus seven sons and grandsons of Shaul, along with Shaul himself, who are impaled. This is an expression of the failure of the Malchut of Shaul. He ultimately is killed in battle. His sons are killed in battle, including the son who should have taken over for him, and seven additional ones impaled later on. This, of course, finds a parallel in the Megillah, except in this time, It's not the descendants of Shaul who are being killed and impaled, but it is the descendants of Shaul or from the family of Shaul, Esther and Mordechai, who are responsible for fighting back against the enemy and hanging Haman, and who was, of course, from Amalek, and 10 of Haman's sons. Why 10 of Haman's sons? That stands in parallel to the 3 plus 7 sons and grandsons of Shaul who are impaled in that story. Let's kind of complete the discussion with one more parallel that's of a different sort. I had mentioned earlier that it's not merely a matter of Esther and Mordechai rectifying the legacy of Shaul. There are many parallels in the Megillah to the story of Yosef in Mitzrayim. Yosef, a son of Rachel, like Esther and Mordechai, Yosef is a ruler, a viceroy in Galut Mitzrayim, the exile of Egypt. And he too, like Mordechai and Esther, saves his brethren from a physical threat. In the case of Esther, it's annihilation by Haman. In the case of Yosef, right, there is a famine, and Yosef saves his family in famine. The reality is that Yosef does something much, I shouldn't say more important, but equally important in the story in Sefer Bereishit. When he brings his kin, his brethren down to Mitzrayim and feeds them. In that story, after a terrible division among the sons of Yaakov, where the sons of Leah and the sons of Rachel, in particular Yosef and his brothers, are at odds with one another, and the brothers of Yosef sell him into slavery, and Yosef gives them a difficult time when they come to Egypt initially, but ultimately Yosef brings the family together in Mitzrayim in advance of the redemption that will take place in Sefer Shemot. If we go back to the very beginning of the story of the division between Yosef and his brothers in Bereishit Perek Lamed Dalet, we find the pasuk Vayir'u Echav, his brothers saw ki oto ahav avihem mikol banav, right, that their father loved him more than all of his sons. Vayisnu oto, they hated him. Velo yachlu dabro l'shalom, they could not speak in peace to him. Well, there is one other pasuk in Tanakh that has the combination of the word Echav, his brothers, the verb Dalet Bet Reish, to speak, and the word Shalom. And that is the very last pasuk in Megillat Esther. This pasuk makes reference or alludes to a number of passages in Tanakh. Its language is very distinctive, but what's important for our purposes here is the language of Echav and the verb Dalet Bet Reish and Shalom. What's the pasuk telling us? Mordechai HaYudi, who had become the viceroy to Achashverosh, was great among the Jews. He was not just somebody who was able to exert influence with the king, right? He also rose to a position of leadership among the Yehudim, v'ratzui l'rov Echav, and he was well accepted among all the multitudes of his brethren. Doresh Tov La'amo, he advocated for good for all of his people, v'dover Shalom, and he would speak for peace for all his offspring. Very distinctive language. But the Megillah is ostensibly telling us here that just as back in the story of Yosef, there was division among Jews, but Yosef, that leader from the descendants of Rachel, brought Klal Yisrael, which was then just a clan, but he brought them together in Mitzrayim in advance of a redemption. So too, Mordechai and Esther, beyond what they do for rectifying the legacy of Shaul HaMelech, also bring B'nai Yisrael together in Galut. They become unifying forces, and with that, they are able to, by implication, lay the groundwork for a redemption that is yet to come. Okay, I think we've gone as long as I'm supposed to, so I'm going to check the chat. I am not seeing any particular.
There are a couple of comments.
We have a question. I'm sorry.
There are a couple of comments in the chat box.
Yeah, I see. Okay. So here I have a question. Who is the king who kills the remainder of Shaul's, who's the remainder of Shaul's family? It's not that all of the remainder of Shaul's family, died. There is a legacy of Shaul, as you see, in the Megillah seems to, even though it doesn't say Mordechai and Esther quite descend from Shaul himself, but they do descend from Kish, Shaul's father. So it's not the case that all of Shaul's descendants are killed. It's not actually a king who kills the remainder of Shaul's family. It involves the story of the Givonim in Sefer Shmuel, so it'll be a little bit hard for me to give the full background here now. The next comment, Mordechai is called a Judean, not a Benjaminite, and not a descendant of Rachel. Yes, so that's an excellent point, and I definitely think that that's part of what's going on. The fact that Mordechai is both an Ish Yehudi and an Ish Yemini, he is called at the beginning like a Judean, quote unquote, not a Judean in terms of being the tribe of Judah, but an Ish Yehudi just means you're from the kingdom of Judah. So he's on the one hand from the kingdom of Judah. His legacy is from Binyamin. But the language of Ish Yehudi does, I think, suggest, as you're suggesting here, that Mordechai brings together the Jews who identify as members of Shevet Yehuda and Jews who identify as members of Shevet Binyamin, because clearly there was very significant tension at some points in history. I mean, there are multiple books in Tanakh that explicitly or implicitly make clear that God chose Yehuda to be the leaders in Eretz Yisrael. For example, you have the story at the end of Sefer Shoftim that sort of very harshly portrays Shevet Binyamin and what happened there with something terrible that was done in the territory of Binyamin. So there's clearly tension there. There's clearly a need for many Svarim and Tanakh to underscore that Yehuda takes precedence for kingship in Eretz Yisrael, but simultaneously, there is this role that Shevet Binyamin can play still in order to rehabilitate their legacy, and that's following the model of Yosef to unify Klal Yisrael in Galut in advance of a redemption that will take place under a leader from Yehuda. So I think you're 100% right about Ish Yehudi and Ish Yemini reflecting that that unification. one more comment, that Mordechai is referred to as a Jew rather than a Hebrew and not a member of Judah's tribe per se. That's correct, right? When it says that Mordechai is an Ish Yehudi, it does not mean that he's a member of the tribe of Yehuda. He's a member of the kingdom of Yehuda. The kingdom of Yehuda is the only kingdom that survives because the northern kingdom goes to exile and does not return. So the kingdom of Yehuda in the south had members of other tribes there, including many people from Binyamin, clearly, certainly members of Levi, whom we obviously still have descendants of Levi today. So when it says Mordechai is an Ish Yehudi, you're absolutely right. It does not mean that he is that he's a member of the tribe of Yehuda, but that he's a member of the kingdom of Yehuda, which is really the same thing as saying Mordechai the Jew. In Hebrew, Yehudi is Jew or Judean. A Judean in this context means a member of the kingdom of what we call Yehud, right? Yehud or Judea, which had members of Binyamin in it, and it's real. That's why the term Jew emerges, because the word Jew, which is really Judean, reflects the fact that the members of Bnei Israel who survived are essentially the ones descend from people in the kingdom of Yehuda who were allowed to maintain their integrity as a people, even in Galut, and who ultimately were allowed to come back. Okay, so I think we're good.
Yeah, any quick comments from anybody on mute and say something?
I wondered whether the silence of God in the Megillah is the paradigm that's followed by Mordechai and Esther?
It's an interesting question. First of all, hello, I think we've met before. The is the humility of, let's say, the humility. Mordechai doesn't really display humility or reserve, but Esther's reserve suggests God's hiddenness. So
I would like to suggest that also explains the kol demama daka, which fails to receive the voice of the announcer of Mashiach.
I hear that. And as for your earlier comment, thematically, Esther is being silent and God's being silent is an interesting question, but certainly from a literary standpoint, you have in Esther's name both references. And as you have in Esther's name, the Esther, which Chazal say Esther comes from the word Seter, which is obviously a drusha. It's not the real source of the name, but I think that is implied from a literary standpoint. The Chazal's drusha that Esther comes from Hester Panim of God. And the reason I think that's correct is because of a literary reference that I haven't seen made anywhere. But there is a pasuk in Dvarim, one of the psukim in Dvarim that speaks of God hiding his face, not the one that Chazal quote in this context, which is Hester, Haster Astir, but that you also have a pasuk Astira Panai Mehem. Right, I will hide my face from him. Erem Acharitam. I will see what their destiny will be. Ki dor tapuchotema banim lo emunba. Now dor tapuchotema. There you have a language of an upside down generation with the verb hepe chaf there, which is a theme in the Megillah, and the verb appears twice in the Megillah. The nahafochu. Right, about how the theme of reversal in the Megillah, plus banim lo emunban, people who have no aluf mem nun, they have no trust in them, they don't trust God. Well, in the very beginning, I think either in that very pasuk or right near that very pasuk where Esther is introduced, it is the very pasuk where Esther is introduced. What's the very first verb you see? Vayhi omein et hadasa. And it's Aleph Mem Nun. Vayhi Omein et Hadassah hi Esther. So I think what the Megillah is doing there is alluding to Astira Panai Mehem Banim Lo Emunba. And Mordechai's sort of commitment, Mordechai's covenantal commitment there is being transmitted to Esther. And if he is Omein her, it doesn't just mean he's raising her. It means he is restoring the commitment to God that's absent in that pasuk and sefer dvarim, banim lo emunba, and that's Esther Astira Panai Mehem. So,
beautiful.
Thank you. Okay, it's good to see you again.
Thank you. Okay. I mean, again, if you were here for all 7 talks, please raise your hand. We'll say thank you very much. Oh, very nice. Okay, I just added up. We were like close to 1,000 people if you add up all the 7 things. So I really want to, thank everybody for coming. But not quite at 1,000, but not 950 about that. Anyways, tomorrow night really a pleasure, and hopefully make Purim more meaningful for all of us, and that we should have Purim to be the month of the Gula, Gula, Mishmat Gula, Gula, and all the beautiful things that happen in the Megillah, we should merit to happen in our time. Tomorrow night, Dr. Shapiro continues. He just started last week on the Musar dispute, so all are welcome, 8:30. We'll have a regular shiur this week, every day, all through Friday. Of course, next Sunday, Purim, we will be giving Mishloach Manot and Matanot Lavyonim and eating and drinking and who knows what else people are doing. So we won't have our regular shiurim next week, Rabbi Liebtag and Dr. Gesundheit, but we'll continue right after that. And please God, we're in the middle of planning some stuff for Pesach, and we look forward to learning with you always, and for your ideas and comments and anything constructive, comments, both positive and negative, we always like to hear. So thank you very much, everybody. Have a wonderful day. Thank you, Dr. Berger. Welcome to Torah Motion. Hope you enjoyed being part it's nice to meet you. I don't think we've ever met.
Same here. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
You were in YU after me, I assume.
That could be. I'm a little older than I sometimes look. So.
Okay. Can I ask whose year were you in? Were you in YU?
I was in Rev Rosenzweig's year for 4 years. I mean, I'm 54 now.
Yeah, so you're still younger than me.
I have, I, there, I, in the past, I have, uh, you know, I have, uh, at least once I have joined in a Torah in Motion Shear. So
of course, no, everybody joins in at some point.
Not the best, my wife is also a relative of I think one of the early supporters. Phil Schwartz from Toronto, who I'm sure you know.
Oh, sure, of course. Phil Schwartz I've known for, you know, my whole life, pretty much.
Right.
And his daughter was in school with me, you know, Adrian, and they've been living in Israel a long, long time. But yeah, I see Phil. I mean, I hope he's doing okay. He's aged, I know, a little bit, but I mean, he's probably close to 90 already. But
yeah, he's about that, yeah.
Yeah, I did see him in Israel a couple of visits ago, but... very nice. It is a small.
Yeah, my wife's name is very, very close to him.
If I can ask,
my wife's name is Dietzov. She her maiden name is Schwartz. I mean, Dietzov Schwartz.
Where did she grow up? Not in Toronto. She didn't grow up in Toronto.
No, in Lawrence. But her father is a first cousin of Phil Schwartz.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah. Very nice. Okay, thank you. Yeah.
Kelman, I mean, the Kelman from Toronto, there are other connections. I mean, I knew Maury Kelman.
Maury's my brother.
And my grandfather who was a Rav in Brooklyn, was quite friendly with the Rabbi
my
Kelman.
Uncle. Abraham Kelman from Prospect Park. Right. That's my uncle. Yeah.
Was that the same Rabbi Kelman who was in Prospect?
He was in Prospect, or he founded the school. He founded the school.
The one who was the principal, right? Okay.
Yeah. So that's my uncle. And who your grandfather? What, on your father's side? Your mother's side?
My mother's side. Yeah.
So what's the name?
Name is Rabinowitz.
Rabinowitz.
My mother's side. Rabinowitz. Okay. My grandfather had a shul, he had one shul called Tiferes HaGra, another shul in Crown Heights called Chovevei Torah, you know, back in the day.
Yeah. Okay. Anyways, very nice. So we're already mishpacha already. That doesn't take long. Baruch Hashem, that's part of the wonderful part of being part of the Jewish people. Am Yehudi, Ish Yehudi, in its many variations. Okay, be well, everybody. Thank you very much. Okay, bye-bye.
Outstanding, Rabbi Kelman. Outstanding.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for coming, as always, in your comments. And thank you. Okay, be well, everybody.
Thank you so much.
Okay, time to eat breakfast or lunch. I don't know where we're up to exactly, but okay. All right, have a great day. Bye-bye.